Hi, this is John Hockenberry, and speaking to someone who clearly loves to listen at the time of their choosing, you should give the WNYC app a try, you know? Not only can you listen to this program, but it'll also automatically search for the kinds of stories and subjects you like. It's really cool, and it's free. There are other apps and radio stations available, but thanks for listening. Here's today's program. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. What a week. And I promise we won't dump on your weekend with more endless and dreary stories of Ebola and ISIS, but we will get behind the Ebola hysteria now that it has arrived in New York City. And we've got a positive story for you here. We will offer a provocative alternative view of what ISIS is all about, and the Holy Quran may have nothing whatsoever to do with it. You'll want to stay tuned for that. A really positive story about the restoration of film footage that shows some superstars from the days of yore. Burt Williams, he was the Jay-Z and Denzel Washington of his time. That's later this hour. And Harry Shearer, the actor, explains his meticulous and disciplined approach to reenacting Richard Nixon in his own words, a show on YouTube that brings Nixon's famous White House recordings to life. But first, New York Mayor de Blasio speaking about perhaps the first crisis of his administration last night.
Testing confirmed that a patient here in New York City had tested positive for Ebola. The patient is now here in Bellevue Hospital.
At that news conference, the mayor explained that the patient, Craig Spencer, is a doctor, member of Doctors Without Borders. He'd been treating Ebola patients in Guinea and returned to New York a week ago, reported feeling sluggish on Tuesday. On Thursday, he came down with a fever, 100.3 degree fever, and was taken by EMTs wearing full Ebola gear to Bellevue Hospital. Authorities are retracing Dr. Spencer's steps in New York, including a ride on a subway, a trip to a Brooklyn bowling alley. His fiancée and two other people who had direct contact with him have been put in isolation. Here's Councilman Mark Levine, who represents the area where Dr. Craig Spencer lives.
In one case, I had a gentleman who I was speaking to who lives across the street who wouldn't shake my hand because he was fearful that because I was somehow connected to the case, I might be contagious. So we have to make sure that kind of irrational fear doesn't spread.
The mayor, city councilmen are trying to keep that fear and panic at a minimum, and there's some signs that they may be effective. Resident Maya Kim lives in the same building as Dr. Craig Spencer. She says she's not worried.
I'm in healthcare, so I understand the ways that it's transmitted, so I'm not, like, freaking out, but it's just crazy that it's in my building. I thought that I would have a risk working in healthcare, but, yeah, I mean, it could happen to anyone.
Certainly can, and nobody knows that better than our next guest. Joining me now, Dr. Emmanuel Darcourt, Senior Health Director at the International Rescue Committee. He joins us in the studio. Dr. Harcourt, give us your sense of the balance between alarm versus reason right now in New York.
Well, John, it's exactly what we thought would happen. We knew that as the epidemic grew and correspondingly people came to respond to the call and worked on this epidemic, that we would get occasional cases that would come to the U.S. They're what we would call sporadic cases. So people who get infected on the front lines, as doctors and nurses are in this case, and would become sick once they came back to the U.S. So there's nothing surprising about that. We're very worried about Dr. Spencer, but in terms of an outbreak in the United States, we are not worried at all. This was properly handled. It's we're doing exactly what my organization, the International Rescue Committee, does in the field in West Africa, which is patiently look after the contacts. But unfortunately, what we also expected is that this would make people upset. And that's understandable. It's what happened in West Africa. It's a very upsetting disease.
But in West Africa, of course, the infection rates were much, much higher. And the extent to which the villages were disrupted, cities were disrupted, that's not anything like what we're seeing here in New York.
There's absolutely no comparison. What's happening in West Africa is a massive outbreak. What's happening in New York is a single case of somebody for very understandable reasons who got infected and is extremely, extremely unlikely to transmit the virus to anyone else.
Let's talk for just a second about the behavior of this individual. We had on our program for a period of weeks Dr. Adam Levine, an ER doctor from Rhode Island, who decided to be a documentarian for us. He did diaries from the field in Bong County in Liberia, a remote area. So he was very much involved with patients. He had contact with patients. When he got back, he told us he was sticking close to home for 21 days and that even some of his friends didn't want anything to do with him until he was cleared of those 21 days. It is a little bit curious to me why Dr. Spencer would have been going to a bowling alley and spending time in the subway. I know he wasn't feeling any symptoms at that time, but is there something a little questionable about that behavior?
I'm not sure, John, and we really would need to know more exactly about what he was doing. I think the scientific fact is that the chances that he would infect anyone in the course of those activities is close to zero. I know Adam, and he's a great doctor, and I know he's also very much on the careful side. So I think that it's understandable, and we have some people who what we would call self-quarantine. But I think that what Dr. Spencer did not put anyone in danger.
And let's just take the other view that maybe he's an incredibly reckless individual, and of course he's not, and we're very much praying for his health, and we certainly admire his trip to West Africa to help with the epidemic. But he presented apparently with a fever of 100.3. At that level of symptoms, because of the way Ebola operates, you're not really an infection danger. You have to be so full of virus to be an infection risk. And at that point, you're so sick, you probably can barely even get yourself to the emergency room. Is that about right?
Well, it's partly true, but mostly is not an infectious risk, not because the illness is just starting, though that does make him less infectious. It doesn't make him non-infectious. But he's mostly not an infectious risk because we don't see people getting infected just from walking the streets or being in the subway or even sharing a bowling ball with someone. If people got infected that way, I can tell you that all of Monrovia would be infected right now because there's a lot more contact and there's a lot of people with Ebola who are walking about. The people who get infected are primarily healthcare workers and the relatives and friends of people who are sick with Ebola and who take direct care with them. Ebola is not that easy to transmit. You really have to be in fairly sustained contact with someone to get it. That's the pattern that we're seeing.
And so Dr. Spencer's fiancée would be someone we'd be worried about at this point.
Well, it very much depends on what kind of contact she had with him. She's obviously being monitored. But given the fact that he declared himself, as he should have, very early in his illness, I would say the level of worry would be relatively low.
And in terms of response here, what is it that's happening in New York that is different from what happened in Dallas? There certainly have been calls for New York to set an example here. I mean, I don't want to compare Dallas to New York. I mean, these are difficult situations for any city. But what can New York do to maybe set straight the protocols here and reassure people that there are mechanisms in place for taking care of this?
Well, fortunately for New York and unfortunately for Dallas, New York is already learning and has learned the lessons from Dallas. So people are much more aware. A number of things are happening. Well, first of all, the patient is taken to a place that is extremely prepared. My wife works at Bellevue as a physician, and so I know that she and just about every physician in the hospital has been fairly extensively briefed on Ebola, even the people who aren't expected to directly take care of Ebola patients. So the hospital is prepared. The public health authorities are extremely prepared. As we get ready to start our own treatment center, we've been collaborating with the Department of Health in the city of New York, and I know they're extremely familiar with Ebola and ready to act. So I think what's happening in New York is a lot of preparation that is paying off, and also a lot of messages from, obviously, we heard Governor Cuomo and Mayor de Blasio calming the situation and getting out facts. And in this case, facts are the best antidote to panic.
And we should recall the proud history of Bellevue Hospital. It's been on the front lines of healthcare problems in New York going back more than a century, whether we're talking about smallpox or the aftermath of 9/11 or the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy. Bellevue is the hospital that can absolutely handle anything. If any hospital can, it's Bellevue.
Absolutely. It's in their DNA. This is not their first outbreak by far. And I could tell you from as the husband of someone who works there that it's very much in the tradition of Bellevue and the mindset to be tougher than anything that's thrown at it.
Dr. Emmanuel Darcourt is Senior Health Director at the International Rescue Committee. He leads a team of public health professionals who provide technical assistance to the health and primary health care programs in Africa, Asia, the Middle East, and Asia. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
So moving to the Middle East now, much has been made of ISIS as some tribe of true believers, the lead army of Islam that wants to restore Muslim society and culture to the peak of power and wealth that it knew back in the 9th century. But the circumstances of the attacks in Ottawa, Canada, while still sketchy, suggest that ISIS operates more as a kind of global fan club for sociopaths, suicidal malcontents who dream of going out with a murderous bang somewhere in the world, or disillusioned loners who see ISIS as a kind of boy and girl scout camp for violent acting out, with the offer of guns, camaraderie, mates, war, fame, a sympathetic comic book god, and access to social media. This is an offer unstable members in societies all over the world may be finding too tempting to refuse. A fight club for our time. We do know that the shooter in Canada converted to Islam and had been living in a homeless shelter, and according to the police commissioner there, was suffering from mental health problems. He also had a history of drug use and unemployment. Is he precisely the kind of individual who hears the call from ISIS? Hussein Rashid is a professor of religion at Hofstra University. Hussein, welcome.
Thank you, John, for having me on today.
What do you think of that analysis of ISIS?
You know, I think you've hit on something really important here in terms of when we look at these so-called radicalized individuals, what we're finding is they're really inspired by Daesh, the Arabic name for ISIS. I'm sort of loath to give them the legitimacy of Islamic to their name, but who are inspired by Daesh because they are mentally unstable. They are loners. They are on the outcasts of society, and they're looking to be they're looking to bring control and order to their lives. And I think Daesh, in their imagination, gives them that opportunity.
So they're more like the Manson family.
I think to a certain extent. I think the idea that they're being inspired. And I think that if we take that viewpoint, you know, we see there have been three horrific attacks recently. In Montreal, there was a Canadian soldier who was attacked in a hit-and-run attack. There was the attack in Ottawa. And recently in New York, we saw four rookie police officers who were attacked by an individual. Initially, the thoughts were that he was a Muslim convert as well. It seems that it perhaps was not related. But if we take the idea of needing order, structure, mental health issues into consideration, then we see these individuals as part of a complex that includes the Oak Creek shooter, that includes the Sandy Hook shooting. I grew up in New York, and I remember the very first theater shooting that happened in America around The Godfather in Long Island. It was 10 minutes from my house. Those individuals come under here as well. So, you know, we've got to start asking bigger questions. We can't, you know, I'm hearing people throwing around terms like sudden jihad syndrome. That tells us nothing in terms of culturally what's happening, how to prevent it. It weakens our national security, and it demeans a religion of 1.6 billion believers worldwide.
So you would say that ISIS, and you don't want to use the name, but I don't have another option, but please forgive me, that ISIS really is more of a cousin to the Hell's Angels motorcycle gang. The idea of you know, antisocial groups that use various aspects of technology to project their power, but within themselves emotionally, they are really relatively powerless people.
And I think that you've hit on two really important points. One is the projection of power that's being used by Daesh. I think when we look at their horrific beheading videos, it really is to goad America and the UK to respond. That gives them legitimacy. The use of Islamic gives them legitimacy. But looking at these individuals, I think one of the most provocative things the NYPD counterterrorism unit did, and unfortunately they let it go, was to look at radicalization as really gang initiation and looking at these individuals as looking for a sense of family, a sense of belonging, and a sense of control that they were otherwise lacking. And again, I think if you frame it in those discussions, it's a much more fruitful way to understand what's happening to these individuals rather than saying, okay, there's a grand ideological motive that doesn't exhibit anywhere else except in this one particular small grouping of people.
But if the Hells Angels had acquired, you know, half of the state of Wyoming and was trying to take over it, it wouldn't exactly be useful to send a busload of psychiatrists to Wyoming to try to fight back. This is a military exercise now, trying to roll them back, unfortunately.
Absolutely. And, I'm not suggesting that when we look at Iraq or Syria that we send in mental health care professionals. But I think here within the United States, what we see is that despite the struggles of numerous minority communities, whether it is African Americans, Latinos, Catholics, Irish, Italians, Arab Muslims, South Asian Muslims, there's always been a process of integration. And therefore, minority communities tend to be well integrated in America. So we're not looking at big cultural shifts here. What we're saying is our social safety net is fraying economically, in terms of health care. Thankfully, we still are able to manage Ebola at the moment here in New York, but we saw what happened in Texas when it frays. So how do we build up a resilient society that brings in more than a security lens and saying, okay, let's take this easy answer and demonize a group of people?
You know, maybe part of the answer is to articulate, and I think many Muslim clerics are doing this, but there's a built-in ambivalence here in the sense that it's hard sometimes to deliver a message which says ISIS is not a part of Islam, but taking it to the next level where traditional Islam is actually fighting against ISIS, that actually if you want to join us as a religion, that's a way to keep yourself from being vulnerable to these gang members who are basically doing something that is utterly anti-Islamic. That's a hard message to articulate.
It is a hard message to articulate, yet it is, as you've pointed out, articulated. There's a letter to Baghdadi. I think it's lettertobaghdadi.com, the so-called caliph of Daesh, where these scholars have said this is against the tradition. So you've got this scholarly response. But the other thing is I think we have to remember is that the vast majority for over a decade of victims of these terrorist attacks have been other Muslims. We see this with what Daesh is doing in Iraq, in Syria, what they did in Afghanistan, what the Taliban did in Afghanistan, what they're doing in Pakistan. That West Point has shown that numerically the number one victims are Muslims, that Muslims are the ones fighting and dying against Daesh. And we can't let that go either. So I think I just want to highlight that point in terms of speaking out.
So who's the point person here against ISIS? The West is the infidel, but who can credibly fight the ideology of ISIS and bring back these people who are so vulnerable before we go?
You know, I don't know if there's any one person in the same way that there's not one person that gave us Daesh. There happens to be a spokesperson there, but really they're operating as independent military units under sort of a nominal allegiance. So how do we address that?
But our understanding, our more rational understanding of what ISIS is certainly a good start.
Absolutely.
Hussein Rashid is professor of religion at Hofstra University. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
America's entertainment identity in the world is one of this nation's most powerful influences on world culture, for good or ill, depending on where you stand. But it has not always been Hollywood driving American entertainment. Jazz, vaudeville, and traveling theater were some of the first subjects of movies when the technology of film was in its infancy. The performers were largely black. The performances were full of personality and style, just the kinds of things that project well on film. Today, the Museum of Modern Art here in New York City premieres a 101-year-old film, the earliest known surviving feature film with a cast of black actors. An exhibition around the work opening at the Museum of Modern Art today is called 100 Years in Post-Production, Resurrecting a Lost Landmark of Black Film History. Joining us now to help us understand the significance of this exhibition and discovery is Jacqueline Stewart, Professor of Cinema and Media Studies at the University of Chicago. Jacqueline, welcome.
Thank you, John.
So what do we learn from this film gem, aside from just simply the fact an all-black cast in a feature film that's not really been seen for 100 years.
Well, this is an extraordinary find. Very few, I mean, a tiny fraction of silent films survive at all. And the records that we have of black participation in the film industry during the silent period is minuscule. So having this document, this moving document of black performers is really extraordinary and helps us to fill out a number of gaps that we have in the history of black performance on film.
And these performers were naturals for film because, you know, they had big gestures in vaudeville. On Broadway, Burt Williams, who's in this film, is a superstar of his time and in many ways lends himself to the kinds of performances that you can capture on film. More formalized, you know, symphonic concerts and that sort of thing are much less satisfying.
Certainly what we see in the kind of energy of the footage that we have here demonstrates a real continuity between the live stage and film performance during this period. The issue of how natural black performers are on film is a really interesting question during this time. Certainly these representations are structured by stereotypes. So there's an expectation that black performers at the time will adhere to some of the conventions of blackface minstrelsy, for example. And Burt Williams is probably the most important figure for thinking about this problem. He was a light-skinned, very virtuoso performer who wore the blackface mask in his stage performances, and he does so in this footage. So it's a convention that he's using that demonstrates how influential minstrel performance was at the time, even for black actors.
What does this film teach us about the emerging process of directing and producing a film? How do we see that developing?
The footage that we have is not a completed film. Actually, the film was never completed and never released. These are rushes. So what we have are multiple takes that the actors do for various scenes across the film. And what we can see is the way that the actors are calibrating their performances, you know, improving things, making adjustments from take to take. And there again is why I think it's so interesting to study this footage, the fact that what we're getting is not simply a continuation of what people did on stage, but a rethinking about how it is that stage performances can be translated to film.
And do we see set pieces in this production here? Do we, you know, what kind of a scene is being constructed here? A romantic scene? What's going on?
Well, it's about Burt Williams is the main character. He's sort of a man about town who is aspiring to win the hand of the local beauty portrayed by Odessa Warren Gray. And what we see are a number of set pieces in which he is in competition with other suitors for this woman. So there's a field day that's sponsored by this fraternal organization, the Lime Kiln Club. And we see them out riding rides, chasing after a greased pig, running races. There's a way in which the film displays certain kinds of theatrical conventions. But then because it's a film, there are other things that can be done that allow the performers to display more nuance in their performances. My favorite scene in this footage is a kissing scene at the very end when Burt Williams does indeed win the hand of Odessa Gray. And we get multiple takes of the two of them kissing, and it seems as though the extended duration of the kiss is supposed to fade to black. But because this isn't a finished film, we just get multiple takes of them with their lips touching.
And the actors are beginning to understand the power of the close-up, something that they would never have on stage.
That's right. We're much closer to them. Another important thing to note about the closer framing that you get in this footage is that we can really see Burt Williams' blackface as an application. I mean, this is not a naturalistic mode of costuming. You can see the edge of the wig that he's wearing. And so not that people who would have consumed his performances, his blackface performances in theater would have thought this is natural, although it was so common at the time. Being able to see sort of the edges of this costume, to see that it's a construction, a fabrication, and to see him performing alongside all of these other black actors who are not wearing blackface, it really denaturalizes blackface and gets us to appreciate the range of performance types and visual styles that Black performers could bring to their film performances.
And underscores the real challenge of putting yourself in the mind of what was going on at the time. It's really remarkably different from our day. I'm wondering where this film was. Whose attic was it in that it was preserved all this time with all the other silent films having been lost?
Right. Well, it's been at MoMA for decades. It was acquired by the founder of MoMA's film library, Iris Berry, in the late 1930s. But like most archives that have lots of material, it much of archival practice is guided by what people are interested in. And so researchers can play a major role in helping archives to identify what people find to be important. The footage has been there, but it has been the work of Ron Magliozzi and other curators in the film department at MoMA who were able to turn their attention to this footage and really think about how it fills gaps in our understanding of the development of American silent filmmaking and Black performance in film in particular.
Well, it's an exciting moment. Jacqueline Stewart, thanks so much for helping us to understand the significance of this find at the Museum of Modern Art.
Thanks, John.
Jacqueline Stewart is a professor of cinema and media studies at the University of Chicago. The late Richard M. Nixon. He's back?
So, what I meant is, with all the agencies of government, what in the name of God are we doing about the government contributors?
Well, the short answer to your question is nothing.
Well, they're doing it to us.
No question, no question.
It's never happened that way before. Johnson screwed everybody. Kennedy, when we went out in 52, the Truman people were kicking the hell out of
me. Sure.
62, they kicked the hell out of me. Part of the problem is the bureaucracy, but part of the problem is our own goddamn fault. There's got to be something we can do.
I don't disagree.
Is there anybody who can do this kind of work? The trouble is, of course, we have too many nice guys around who just want to do the right thing.
Too many nice guys. Yes, that was Nixon's problem. What you're listening to is not National Archive tape, but its authenticity comes from the detailed sensitivity and, dare I say, reverence for Richard Nixon and the time and the characters of the Watergate era and before and after from comedian Harry Shear, who's released a 6-part series on YouTube called Nixon's The One. Harry Shear joins us now. Harry, this is remarkable stuff here. It gives me chills and goosebumps. It must have been a lot of fun going back into history like this.
Yeah, I don't regard it as history because, to me, Nixon's always been around. Even after he died on my radio show, I started doing a series of sketches based on 3 improbable premises. 1, that there's a place called heaven. 2, that Nixon got in. And 3, that he's still taping. So, yeah, he's such a central character to the American 20th century to me. He's a self-made man and a self-destroyed man, so he wrote his own punchline. But he gave us this incredible gift. Willy-nilly, he recorded almost every waking word of his for 5.5 years. And so I decided to, with my writing partner Stanley Cutler, who's a world-renowned historian on the tapes, to focus on these conversations that are not about Watergate, they're not about Vietnam, this is not about history or politics. This is conversations revealing of the character, the incredibly complex, twisted, resentful, paranoid character of this guy.
Well, here's a realization of a scene that followed a news conference on the 16th of April in 1971.
I must say, I was tremendously impressed with the delicacy with which you handled those foreign policy questions, because this was a tough moment.
Well, the main thing was not to give anything. I mean, we didn't give any the goddamn thing away.
Not a thing.
I didn't give a thing about, frankly, Henry. I didn't give a thing away about Vietnam. Mm. Didn't give a thing away about China. I said, I'm not going to talk about that.
Beautiful.
I said, this is not the time to talk about
that. That was beautiful.
Yeah.
What is that, Berlioz playing in the background? He sounds like a 19th century, I don't know, European leader with megalomaniac kind of, I don't know what.
This was late in the evening. He actually was listening to music as Kissinger started the conversation. And he was, as you could tell, a little bit in his cups at that point. That was an interesting challenge, was to play that Nixon, the Nixon who had been spending a bit of the evening with his friend, the bottle. But this is one of a series of incidents where Kissinger is just being as obsequious as humanly possible. You know, he knew that Nixon didn't like two of Kissinger's primary characteristics. He was Jewish and he was a professor at Harvard, two things Nixon loathed. And Kissinger was aware of this, but he needed Nixon. He needed Nixon to have access to power that Kissinger craved. So this relationship, we devote an entire episode of the series to this very, very strange, tortured relationship between these two very smart people who were using each other, or thought they were using each other.
You know, and it seems so not American. It really seems like some scene from the Louis the 16th.
From the court, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we know that people in power surround themselves with sycophants, but we've never heard it before. And this is the way it sounds.
Very interesting thing. So few of those who engage in espionage are Negroes. Very lucky that way. As a matter of fact, very few of them become communists. But the Negroes, if you were nuts enough to plant Negro spies.
Oh, well, they're not as intellectual, though. They're not smart enough.
It may be.
They're not smart enough to be spies.
But
they're not as intellectual.
The Jews are barn spies. Do you know something I've learned? They're just in it up to their necks.
Well, the basic devious, simple is deviousness.
I know. Also an arrogance. An arrogance that, that's what makes a spy, you know? He puts himself above the law.
Wow, no. That's just so astounding. He's such an authority on this. That's what's really chilling.
Well, he speaks with this mien of authority about all these people that he dislikes, and it's very strange. But also, of course, the irony in the light of later developments that he's talking about other people as thinking of themselves above the law.
I love this scene with Billy Graham, who was a very trusted advisor.
The real question is whether this country is going to believe anything. Now, we all have different degrees of religions and different ways of expressing, but among the professors and the associate professors in the colleges and universities and the junior colleges and high schools, I think 90% of them are atheists or worse. They have no confidence in themselves. They have no faith in this country.
Well, they're undermining the country.
And they're communists.
You know, he's standing as the savior and the protector of what he regarded as traditional American values. We've heard this, of course, from others before and since. Billy Graham wasn't just sitting in on all these conversations with Nixon. He had insinuated himself in the White House back in the days of Eisenhower. And you have to wonder, what was it about this set of relationships that attracted him so much? He apparently just liked to render unto Caesar. But he's sitting there, and he and Nixon talk about the media and about the Jews and about all of this stuff.
I think that the really scary thing is that the media control used to be, in certain places, the writers on television have always been Jewish. Yep. Jack Benny's writers and all those people, they always have been. But now, what's become the old-time press corps? The old-time White House press corps wasn't Jewish.
Yep.
But you look at what covers the president today, and it's really kind of scary.
In some way, these conversations are so remarkable because you have to keep in mind the meter is running on this. This is while we're paying him to be president of the United States.
Right.
And they're just having what sound like really demented college late-night bull sessions.
Do you feel like you know him better, Nixon, from all this?
A little bit. I mean, there's this famous scene. It had been videotaped and traded around for years of the 8 minutes before he delivers his resignation speech, which always just struck me as goofy. And he's about to undergo the live humiliation on national TV of resigning. And what does he do when he walks into the Oval Office? He starts cracking jokes with the crew.
Hey, you're better looking than I am. Why don't you stay here? Blondes, they say, photograph better than brunette. Is that true or not?
I don't know, sir.
Or you... You are blonde, aren't you?
No, sir.
Redhead?
No, thinning.
We're the same.
And I always thought this was goofy. And as we were rehearsing it, I did have an epiphany. I realized what was going on. To avoid being in the moment of maximum humiliation, he was already plotting his next campaign, his campaign for rehabilitation. The guys on the crew were going to walk out that night and say to their friends and family, well, he wasn't depressed. He wasn't upset. He wasn't mad. He was a nice guy. He was cracking jokes. The wow. next campaign was beginning.
Wow. That's amazing. Comedian Harry Shearer is the voice behind Richard Nixon in the new 6-part series on YouTube called Nixon's the One. Harry Shearer, thank you.
Thank you, John.
You know, this has been an absolute eye-opener for me.
Quite an eye-opener, this thing.
If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Have a great weekend. This is The Takeaway.